Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. Now that the U.S. Olympic Committee has chosen Boston to be the U.S. contender for the 2024 Summer Olympics, let the games begin. Or maybe we should ask the question, like, how much is this going to cost? Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is promising a series of public hearings to answer that and other questions.
But until then, he's promoting Boston's Olympic bid as a boon for the city. Here he is last night during his State of the City address when he said Boston now competes with the world as America's city.
Whatever the outcome, Boston will prove itself a global leader. The whole world will soon know what we have always known. Boston is exceptional.
But beyond the cheerleading, what will it cost and who's going to pay for it? And what will the city be left with when the TV cameras and the well-tuned athletes are all gone?
My next guest says that the games are more akin to something else that Boston has opposed, gambling. The games, he says, are a gamble, with taxpayers frequently left holding the bill. Joining me now is Andrew Zimbalist. He's a professor of economics at Smith College, and his new book is Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. And Andy Zimbalist, good to have you back. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Listeners, we want to hear from you in this conversation. What are your questions about the economics of hosting the Olympics? Are you worried about the bill, or is it worth the gamble? What do you think? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Andy, I want to ask you, you review decades worth of big sporting events like the Olympics and the World Cup. What's been the track record in cities that host them?
It's not good. There are a few examples of success under very special circumstances and in a different time period. I think that Los Angeles in 1984 and Barcelona in 1992 arguably were successful stories. If you look at the more recent examples, and I think most instructively the example of London, it's very hard to make the argument that it was a plus, and in particular the arguments that are being put forward by John Fish and Mayor Walsh promising no new taxes, I think lack credibility based upon other experiences. London, for instance, started out with a bid of $4 billion. They ended up spending somewhere between $15 and $20 billion. Part of the promise back then was that it was going to be privately funded, not publicly funded. But it turned out that they needed $1.6 billion to during the 17 days of the Games to operate the Games from the public treasury. There was supposed to be an Olympic Village that was going to be paid for and constructed entirely by a private developer. The private developer pulled out, and London had to step in, $1.7 billion worth. Just last week, we found out from Pyeongchang in South Korea that's going to be hosting the next Winter Olympics that they had hoped to pull in $769 million in 2013 and 2014 in private corporate sponsorships. They got less than 2% of that. Hmm. So the notion that, A, this is actually going to cost $4.5 billion instead of something closer to $15 or $20 billion, and B, that it's going to be entirely privately funded, I don't think are credible notions.
Hmm. Based on the history. But you said there have been examples of cities that have benefited from the Olympics, and you mentioned L.A. and Barcelona. What did they do right or that turned out well for them?
Los Angeles hosted the Games in 84. They were awarded the Games in the late 70s. Nobody else wanted them in 1978. The reason nobody else wanted them is there had been three very poorly performing, if not dismally performing, Olympic Games before that in Mexico City, Munich, and Montreal. Los Angeles went to the IOC and said, number one, we'll do this if you let us use our stadiums from the 1930s when we hosted the Olympics. And number two, we want you to guarantee us against any losses. And the IOC had no choice. They had no leverage at that time. And they said, okay. So that together with very clever and innovative management by Peter Uberoth, who was the head of the Los Angeles Olympic Committee, brought them a $215 million surplus at the end of the game. So that was a successful Games. Didn't have a major impact on the economy of California, but nonetheless, it was a successful Games. 1992 Barcelona is quite complicated, but basically what happened is after Franco died in 1975, the citizens of Barcelona had a new vision, and the planners had a new vision for the city because that city had been subjected to decades of basically being ignored by the Franco government, and helter-skelter industrial development. So you had a development of a warehousing and manufacturing district that was in between the central streets of the city and the Mediterranean Sea. The plan was to get rid of that and to open up the city to the sea once again. They had that plan in place, along with some other elements to it. That happened in the late 1970s, and it was in the early 1980s that some people said we could fit the Olympics into our plan. It might help us. So it was after the plan was already in place. It was after a plan that had been democratically discussed and generated was in place. They said, let's see if we could put the Olympics into that. The plan was the priority. The Olympics were subordinated to the pre-existing plan.
I see.
So that hasn't happened again. The typical sequence is, the Olympics could come to our city. Let's make a plan to accommodate what the IOC needs.
But this does sort of lead to one of the arguments that we're hearing from the proponents, and that is this idea that the Olympics will help a city do what it already wants to do. For example, Boston can really beef up its public transportation system. It can take advantage of the need to build housing for the athletes and convert it into middle-class housing or low-income housing later. What about that argument? Using the facilities and the sort of energy that is invested in sprucing up the city and improving its various infrastructures for the long-term benefit?
I think it's like using a sledgehammer to cut a piece of butter.
I've never tried that.
Well, apparently we're trying it in Boston right now. Look, insofar as we have a transportation infrastructure plan that's concrete, and we have decided politically to fund that and go ahead with it anyway and use public federal highway funds for it and so on and so forth. And that specific plan in its details, not in generalities, which is to say replacing potholes, upgrading bridges, extending the MPA. But if the very specifics of it overlap with or coterminous with what the Olympics needs, then yes, that could be something that was a benefit. I still think we can do that anyway, and we ought to be able to do it anyway. But what we haven't seen are those details. And what I would suggest to you will happen is that there will be special transportation arteries and special provisions and parking lots to service Olympic venues that, in fact, the city doesn't need and, in fact, are not in the city's plans today.
Interesting. Listeners, we're talking to Andrew Zimbalist. He's an economist from Smith College, and he's author of the new book, Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. We're talking about it here in Boston for obvious reasons as Boston makes its bid for the 2024 Summer Olympics. Give us a call if you've got comments or questions, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I want to introduce Andy Zimbalist, stand by. I want to introduce Shirley Leung. She's a columnist for the Boston Globe, and she's been writing about what the Games could mean for the city. And Shirley, welcome to Radio Boston. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
We're asking you on today because you have a slightly different perspective. And in your column, you looked at an interesting lesson from New York's failed bid for the 2012 Olympics. And you write, the mere act of putting together a full-blown bid got government and civic leaders to focus on the future of New York. What did you find out in the case of New York?
Well, New York, we're actually taking a page from New York. The John Fish and some of the leaders of Boston 2024 have talked to Dan Doktoroff, who put together the bid for New York under Mayor Bloomberg. And I found out that they also put together a privately funded Olympic bid. They had all these plans. They made a lot of plans to expand their subway, one of their subway systems. They also proposed building new stadiums, new housing developments for the Olympic Village. And what I found is that they won in a big way. Even though they lost the Olympics to London, they got almost a half a century of planning done in about a 3 or 4 year period. They got everybody, the government worked really well on a deadline. And as Dan Doktoroff told me, there is nothing like a deadline, an Olympic deadline. You have to get everything done. You have to have everything in place by a certain time. So all these approvals got done. City officials, state officials, community leaders, they all worked together to get all these venues approved, all these districts approved in time for the IOC vote. And I think in New York got the U.S. was a U.S. nominee back in 2002, and they found out in 2005 that they had lost to London. So they got a lot done in about 2.5 years, and this is exactly where we are in Boston. And so I argue that Boston, we have an win or lose, we have an opportunity to win big here in terms of thinking about the future of Boston.
But what's your response, and we'll bring Andrew Zimbalist back into the conversation, but what's your response to what you heard him say about the economics of the game, about the economics of past games?
You know, the IOC recognizes that maybe other cities have gone overboard in terms of impressing the world, in terms of, that maybe they built too many stadiums, maybe they, went a little overboard with other developments. And right now, the IOC just passed, last month, a provision to have a more scaled down, a more feasible Olympic Games. They don't want white elephants anymore. They don't want the reputation. They want more cities to compete to host the Olympics. And in that vein, the Boston organizers proposed what they call a walkable, a sustainable, a compact Olympics. We lean a lot on existing structures, on temporary structures, and we're going to get a lot of universities to build athletic facilities that they can use after the Olympics. The Olympic Village that I believe is being proposed in Dorchester afterwards would go to UMass Boston as dorms.
Sure.
So it's things like that.
All right, those kinds of things make you feel pretty good, or at least encourage you to want to let this process play itself out. Andy Zimbalist, respond to that. Specifically, this idea that the IOC has has moved away from the big white elephant approach to the Olympics.
Well, let's start with New York City, because to quote Dan Doktoroff on whether it was successful or not, since he was the head of the New York City organizing effort, is, I think, questionable. I know her article also cites a professor who talked about the value of rezoning. I'd like to know more about that professor and what other professors think. But look, the Olympic plan that they had in New York City was not implemented. Part of the plan was to put a billion-dollar stadium between 31st and 33rd Street and 10th and 11th Avenues after they put a $400 million concrete slab over the rail yards. That was a ludicrous plan. It would have been used by the New York Jets 10 days out of the year. The fact that New York City lost this bid probably was beneficial, and I would suggest that it might actually be beneficial to Boston if we lose our bid. In terms of the IOC, look, what Thomas Bach has done is he recognized that several cities, because of, through referendums in some cases, in other cases through changes of heart by governments, several cities dropped out of the bidding process for the 2022 Winter Olympics. Most recently, it was Oslo, but previously in Krakow, in Stockholm, in Munich, there were referendums, and the people voted that they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So he's left now a choice between two cities in authoritarian countries, Almaty, Kazakhstan, and Beijing in China. Those are his choices for the 2022. So they've made a big publicity campaign about how they are going to honor cities' own needs going forward, mm-hmm. and how they're going to respect frugality, and how they're going to respect the cities that want to use existing venues. If that's what they wanted to do, they should have picked Los Angeles, because Los Angeles has a lot less building to do than Boston. And Boston is able to, if we do host the games, we will be able to play archery or have archery at MIT, and we will be able to have field hockey at the Harvard Stadium, and we will be able to have badminton at Tufts. All of those things will happen. But the big items, we have to build. We have to build an Olympic stadium on 100 acres of land. That's an IOC requirement. We have to build an auditorium. We have to build a velodrome. We have to build or maybe use a convention center reconstructed for a media center. The big items still have to be built. The $4.5 billion figure that is put out by Boston 2024 is pie in the sky. It cannot happen.
Shirley, I want to come back to you. We do have a system of hearings that's going to be set up. There's going to be at least a dozen hearings across the city for people to sort of air their concerns. Tell me what sort of questions you have that you'd want to air out in these hearings.
I mean, I think I want to go back to what Professor Zimbalist talked about earlier, is about public funding. I know the organizers have used the terms, and Mayor Walsh has talked about no public funds. But if you take a closer look, they're actually talking about no public funds for operating the games. And so, I mean, I do think public funds will be used. I think the price tag will be bigger. It's a question about how much bigger. And I feel like the organizers should be a bit more transparent on that. I mean, we know that the federal government will have to kick in $1 billion of security. So that's public funds. And so I think in the case of New York, when they got the stadium done, they finally got one of the stadiums done. Yeah, the Olympic Stadium ended up rolled up into being the Met Stadium. And in doing that deal, that required some money from the state, some state financing. So there was public money involved. And so I feel that the organizers very quickly have to kind of explain to the public what exactly they mean about no public money, because I think there will be public money. It's a bit, they're defining it in their own terms, though.
Now, Andy, I know you feel there'll be a lot of public money, but if I could, I want to get you to hold that thought, because I want to bring a couple of callers into this conversation. Let's go to John, who's calling from Melrose. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I think Boston ought to be honored, and if guys like Professor Zimbalist wants to strike a hard deal, you know, it's great to have people like that involved. But what you don't know around here is that Boston is not really a world city. It's a very efficient city, and it's an American city. It's a historic city. But I think this would really put Boston on the world map.
So you're obviously, John, you support it. Andy, respond to John. This idea that a big global sporting event would really put Boston on the map.
So one of the claims that's made by the boosters for the Olympics and also for the World Cup is that after being on the world stage and being on a billion television sets around the world, that the city will benefit from increased tourism, increased trade, increased foreign investment. All of the scholarly work that's been done by disinterested people, that is people who are not being paid by either side and just trying to understand what happens and looking at all of the data, using econometric modeling to tease all this stuff out, have found that that's not true, that there is no long-term benefit for tourism. There is no long-term benefit in increased trade or foreign investment. So it's a nice idea. It should be lovely if all of a sudden Boston became even more popular in the eyes of the world than it is today. But again, there's no evidence that that's happened in the past. And I think that it's unrealistic to expect it to happen for the first time in Boston.
All right. Well, John, thanks for that call. Shirley, you make the point in your column today that Boston now has 2.5 years to prepare its bid for the IOC. And you write that Boston's chances of actually winning are pretty good.
Yeah, I wrote about, according to Dan Doktoroff, who's been studying this, and I think my colleague John Powers had a piece over the weekend as well, for, you know, when Chicago and New York lost their bids, the United States Olympic Committee had a very bad relationship with the IOC. And under the current leadership, they've repaired that relationship. And so now the IOC looks more favorably on the U.S. IOC. And, you know, a lot of money, the U.S. provides a lot of money to the IOC in terms of from the hosting an Olympic Games, I mean, or from the Olympic Games in general, I should say. There are a lot of the sponsors are U.S. sponsors. A lot of the television money comes from the U.S. So, you know, there'll be a lot of pressure to bring it back to the U.S. And by 2024, it'll be more than a quarter of a century since the U.S. hosted a Summer Olympic Games. So if you look at it that way, a lot of things are going our way, or going whoever the U.S. nominee is. And in this case, it's Boston.
Right, it's Boston. So Andy Zimbalist, sort of same question to you. I mean, you've made it clear how you feel about whether or not this would be a good idea, and you clearly believe it would not be. But do you agree with that? Does it look like the IOC might favor Boston?
So what happened was that the United States gave 7% of its, of all of the television money that was generated in broadcasting the Olympics, the United States got 12% of that. And countries around the world were complaining, because there are over 200 countries. Why should one country get one-eighth of that money? The United States negotiated with the IOC, and they're going to gradually cut that share down to 7%. And so, yes, on the basis of that, there is a somewhat better relationship. And, yes, I also believe that there's a better chance. But we're going to be up against Paris and Berlin or Munich. We're going to be up against Italy. We're going to be up against Doha and Melbourne and St. Petersburg, some world-class cities. So it's by no means a sure thing that we would get it.
All right. Well, that's Andrew Zimbalist. He is an economist at Smith College, author of Circus Maximus, called The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. Andy Zimbalist, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Shirley Leung, columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you as well for joining us. We're very grateful.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, a new app aims to bridge the gap between doctors and patients once the appointment is over. I'm Anthony Brooks with Lisa Mullins. This is Radio Boston.